Okay, it's my great pleasure now to introduce Vishva Dixit from Genentech. Why so many dead ways to die? The very illustrative picture.
Great, thanks. I'd like to first say what a delight it is to be here. It's just a great meeting, just beautiful city. We have to talk about a sabbatical somewhere along the line here. And what I'd like to do today is go over some recent work, and sort of really it's curiosity-driven work. And I'm going to start fairly slowly, give you an introduction to the system, and then we'll pick up speed. We'll pick up speed especially because Miriam is here now. So I want to address a fundamentally important question in cell biology, which is how are leaderless cytokines that are often generated by the inflammasome, like IL-1 beta and IL-18, how are they released? So that's the question. And the reason for the question is, as I will emphasize, cytokines like IL-1 beta and IL-18 do not have a signal peptide. So they do not go through the Golgi route of secretion. But before we get there, let me introduce the inflammasome. Now, the inflammasome is considerably complex machinery, but we can think of it in two parts. There's the canonical pathway that responds to many mediators of inflammation, PAMPs and DAMPs. And there's a non-canonical pathway that we discovered a few years ago that is dedicated to the presence of intracellular LPS. Now, the hallmark of the non-canonical pathway is the involvement of caspase 11. Remember, caspases are proteases, they're cysteine proteases, and they cleave after an aspartic acid residue. And that will become important later in my talk. Now, the final step in this cascade, whether you activate the canonical pathway or the non-canonical pathway, the penultimate step is activation of caspase 1. This is a protease that is going to cleave pro-IL-1 beta and pro-IL-18 to give you the mature cytokines that do not have a signal peptide. So the question in about 2015 was, how do these cytokines get out of the cell? And our studies are largely limited to cells of the innate immune system, especially bone marrow-derived macrophages. So I won't be talking about neutrophils. So that's the question. What was evident was that a form of cell death termed pyroptosis could be mediated by caspase 11, and caspase 1, and this somehow damaged the plasma membrane, allowing for the release of these leaderless, signal peptide-less cytokines. All right, so just to emphasize, even though caspase 11 is a protease, it operates in this cascade through caspase 1. Caspase 1 is the protease responsible for the maturation of the cytokines pro-IL-1 beta, pro-IL-18, and either caspase 1 or caspase 11 can induce this membrane damage that will allow for the release of the mature cytokine. So how does this membrane damage happen? Well, in order to address that, we took a forward genetic screen where cohorts of mice, up to 10,000 breeding pairs, were subjected to the mutagen ANU. We isolated bone marrow-derived macrophages from these mutagenized mice. And we simply asked, is the apparatus for secretion of IL-1 beta, is that broken? Right? So this is the assay system. We are looking at IL-1 beta secretion in response to LPS. Each of these dots is a cohort of mice, mutagenized mice. And as I mentioned, caspase 11 is a component of this non-canonical pathway, and the caspase 11 mutant does not respond as evidenced by low levels of secreted IL-1 beta on the y-axis. But just as unresponsive was this beast here, ENU B11. So what was ENU B11? ENU B11 was Gesdermindi. We'd never heard of it. Went to the library, said it's part of a family, no obvious signal sequence or transmembrane segment, and function unknown. So that really helped. That was a joke. Anyway. So is Gesdermindi really involved in the secretion of IL-1 beta? Well, let's look at the data. So what we're going to look at is the processing of pro-IL-1 beta, which is about 31 kD, to the processed form, about 17 kD. And we can look at that by simply doing an immunoblot. We are then going to measure release of the processed IL-1 beta by doing an ELISA. Okay, now let's look at the data. We're looking at wild-type macrophages treated with an inflammasome activator. You will see pro-IL-1 beta giving rise to processed IL-1 beta in the presence of an inflammasome activator, right? And if you then measure secreted IL-1 beta, copious amounts are found in the conditioned medium, right? So that looks pretty good. But now look at this. We took the Gesdermindi null and activated the inflammasome. You get just as much processed P17, processed IL-1 beta, but it's not there in the medium. So this said that Gesdermindi, whatever it does, is required for the release of IL-1 beta from the cell's interior into the extracellular milieu. Now what we further discovered was that the pro-inflammatory caspases, caspase 1 and caspase 11, can in fact cleave Gesdermindi. And I'll just show you the data here for caspase 11. When we look at caspase 11 on exposure to LPS, we see the emergence of this 30 kD band. If we take purified Gesdermindi and incubate it with caspase 11, we see the emergence of two bands, P30 and P20. If we sequence the cleavage site, it's at a bona fide caspase cleavage site, aspartate 276. So the summary of this slide is that pro-inflammatory caspases, such as caspase 11, can cleave Gesdermindi to give you two fragments, P30 and P20. Now you would say, big deal. Is cleavage important? Who cares? So in order to address that question, we made a knock-in mouse where aspartate 276 was converted to an alanine, so it could not, this Gesdermin could not be cleaved. It could not give you P30 and P20. And now we took bone marrow-derived macrophages from wild-type mice and mutant mice, stimulated with LPS, and looked at IL-1 beta release. And of course, wild-type mice make copious amounts of IL-1 beta, or their macrophages do. The Gesdermindi knockout makes hardly any IL-1 beta in the conditioned media, but just as hypomorphic was the processing dead Gesdermindi. So now you have to say to yourself, not only is Gesdermindi required for the release of IL-1 beta, but it needs to be proteolyzed. There's no arguing with this data. You don't need statistics. So we wondered what could be the mechanism, and we thought maybe this is the way the membrane gets damaged and IL-1 beta is released. And that one of these fragments, either P30 or P20 that's generated, is membrane damaging. So we expressed them individually in cells and looked for the uptake of a nuclear dye. And indeed, when you expressed P30, you shattered the plasma membrane and a nuclear dye was rapidly taken up. So P30 is the entity that is responsible for damaging the membrane. Okay. So this, we thought possibly what happens is once you generate P30, it must oligomerize to give you a pore. And we showed that by taking purified liposomes and incubating them with P30. And lo and behold, you could see these pores forming on negative stain electron microscopy. And we calculated it out to be a 24-mer symmetric protomer. So 24 P30s coming together to give you a fairly large pore of about 15 nanometers internal diameter. And then we said we have to understand this at the atomic level. But as life goes, we were beaten to it by Hao Wu. So I'll just summarize her results here. She did the structure of Gesdermin D. This is the full-length P30, P20. Once the protease cleaves, the P30 unveils this beta sheet that inserts into the membrane to give you this beta barrel structure. Okay, so it's a large pore. I think this confirms what we saw by electron microscopy, but more at atomic detail. But what it says is that the channel, the pore, is P30. It binds to the plasma membrane, oligomerizes, and forms pores. And that is the mechanism. So the model we have now for the release of these leaderless cytokines is whether you activate the non-canonical or the canonical pathway, you get cleavage of Gesdermin D, and the P30 fragment assembles into a pore in the plasma membrane. You subsequently get collapse of the electrochemical gradient. The pore is about 18 to 20 nanometers, so it allows for the release of IL-1 beta, which is 4.5 nanometers. Because you have damaged the membrane with these large pores, you get osmotic forces at work and rupture and the release of large molecular weight substances such as LDH. So this work was published in 2015 by my own group of our forward genetic screen and by Feng Shao, who used a CRISPR-based screen. Now, since that time, since the discovery of Gesdermin D, there's been a cottage industry on the Gesdermins, but I just want to bring your attention to the following recent papers that talk about the evolutionary conservation of this family. So there are Gesdermins in coral, there are Gesdermins in fungi, and most strikingly, they're bacterial Gesdermins that are part of the innate immune response in bacteria. So when bacteria are infected by phage, they switch on an operon. Part of the operon is a bacterial Gesdermin. The other part of the operon is a bacterial protease that processes that bacterial Gesdermin and kills the infected cell. So really, this is quite remarkable conservation of evolutionary principles. But now I'm going to tell you something really surprising, something that violates what your high school biology teacher taught you, and that cell lysis is not a passive event. How can I say something that outrageous? Well, it came out from this genetic screen, right? So we did this genetic screen, and now we have thousands of strains of mice are being analyzed. And you stimulate with LPS, and the bone marrow-derived macrophages make copious amounts of IL-1 beta. Remember, we are looking for the system to be broken. But as a sanity screen, a sanity check, we always measure LDH because, you know, when you make these big pores in cells, collapse their electrochemical gradient, they die. And they die and they release LDH. And we measure LDH in the clinical labs for cell death and in the research labs. In fact, they're kits for LDH. And so there's always unison. When IL-1 beta is released, LDH release goes hand in glove. But look at this strain. IL-1 beta is released. This NINJ1 strain, LDH is not. How can that be? That's impossible. I'm like, no, this is not possible. Now, I should say that IL-1 beta is relatively small, 17 kDa. LDH is relatively large, 140 kDa. So it seems that IL-1 beta release in the NINJ1 mutant macrophages is fine, But LDH releases it. I'm like, this makes no sense. This is some ENU weirdness. Let's knock it out. So here, the open bars are wild-type macrophages. Red bars are Ninja knockout macrophages. And we're going to either not stimulate them or stimulate them with LPS. And we'll first look at the release of IL-1 beta. And you will see on LPS exposure, wild-type and Ninja knockouts make equivalent amounts of IL-1 beta in the secreted medium. So that means in the Ninja knockout, IL-1 beta is getting out fine. Presumably, gasdermin D pores are intact. We can show that with a pore-specific antibody that the Ninja knockout and the wild-type cells make the pores. But now let us look at the release of LDH. Wild-type macrophages release LDH. Ninja-1 null knockouts don't. How is this possible? Because what I'm saying is that you've damaged the membrane irreparably, and what we've been taught is that there are passive forces at play, many of them osmotic in nature, that lead to the lysis of the cell and the release of large molecular weight substances, including large molecular weight dams, intracellular pathogens, etc. But nobody has really addressed the role of cell rupture because we've always assumed that is passive. Now, Ninja-1 is an unusual protein. It is N-terminus out, C-terminus out. It's on the plasma membrane, has two transmembrane domains. Okay? But what this says is that all of a sudden we have a genetic tool to separate lethal membrane damage from membrane lysis. Now, I should emphasize, I don't have the time to show you the data, that the Ninja-1 knockout cells, when they're exposed to LPS or other stimuli that I'll show you, are deader than doornails, but they're just not releasing LDH. They're just not releasing high molecular weight proteins. They're just not lysing. So, the model then is that once you get membrane damage, in this case with gasdermin D pores, while the pore itself is sufficient for the release of IL-1 beta and IL-18, and this leads to the demise of the cell, subsequent lysis and release of large molecular weight proteins is dependent on this plasma membrane protein Ninja-1. Now you're saying this is something odd with LDH or something bizarre. But you can do a secretome analysis, LPS-induced secretome, and in Ninja-1 null cells, there are many, many proteins whose release is attenuated. The cell, even though dead, even though perforated, is just not lysing and releasing high molecular weight proteins. So this would be like, Miriam has a rotating graduate student. She says to the student, go and put cyanide on the cells this evening, and in the morning I want you to measure LDH release. And the student comes and says, guess what, the cells died, but there was no LDH release. Now Miriam would show the student the door, right? But it's true for Ninja-1. It's hard to really come to grips with this. Now, what's even more important is that this isn't some unusual form of plasma membrane damage. So here we are looking at cell rupture, LDH release, open bars are wild-type macrophages, red bars are Ninja-1 knockout macrophages, and without any treatment, there's about 18% basal release. If you freeze-thaw them, then of course there's no difference. If you treat with nigericin, a potassium ionophore, now you see there is a dramatic difference with the Ninja-1 knockouts not releasing LDH. But you look at cisplatin, that has nothing to do with gasdermin D. And still, you see that the death of these cells is associated with decreased release of LDH. So all forms of cellular lysis seem to work through Ninja-1. So you can damage cells with poisons, with UV, with whatever, but you need NinjaOne for efficient lysis. Now, this is what we've been taught, right? You treat a cell here with nigericin, a poison, it balloons up, and then it implodes, right? This is wild-type cells. And that's what we've been taught. But now look at this. This is the NinjaOne knockout, and this is overnight recording, okay? Whoa. You got to see this. Look at that. Look at these ghosts of membranes. They persist overnight. I mean, if you let them go for a couple of days, they'll eventually lyse. But this isn't a short time period. I mean, this is just startling. Everybody sees this. Nobody has seen this. Cells are dead. They're just not lysing. Now, just like Gesdermin D, NinjaOne is an unexpected discovery, ill-characterized protein, 152 amino acids, so it's a small protein, has two transmembrane regions. It's conserved in evolutionary time, easily found in Drosophila, and if you look harder, you can find it in other life forms. mRNA is widely expressed in many cells, but especially enriched in myeloid cells. NinjaOne has been reported to be induced in Schwann cells following nerve injury, so there may be an element of induction. Now, when we knock out NinjaOne, about a quarter of the mice succumb in the first month to hydrocephalus. But once they get past that checkpoint, then they seem to do okay. Okay, and we don't know much about the hydrocephalus. Now, we need an assay for NinjaOne, because NinjaOne functions when cells are dead. And you will ask yourself, why would evolution conserve a mechanism that functions when cells are dead? That makes no sense, but I'll get to that. So we need a function for NinjaOne. We need a surrogate. And one surrogate is, if you just overexpress NinjaOne, this is human and mouse in 293T cells, they're going to obliterate those cells. They're going to shatter the plasma membrane. And that is true also with the fly ninj expressed in human 293T cells obliterates those cells, shatters their plasma membrane. It's highly conserved. Anyway, this overexpression serves as a surrogate assay. Now we can look at which region of the molecule is important. We're going from the N-terminus to the C-terminus. This is an amphipathic helix that's on the extracellular region, two transmembrane domains. This is a conservation score in evolutionary time. Lower the score, more highly conserved. The amphipathic helix is highly, highly conserved. This is an ALAS scanning mutagenesis where we express the wild-type NinjaOne. It kills cells. Then we do a 5 ALAS scan across the molecule. The extreme N-terminus is quite tolerant, but as soon as you mess with the amphipathic helix, you lose the ability to shatter plasma membranes. Now, what's happening? So we look at NinjaOne. This is endogenous NinjaOne at time zero, and then it's a time course after nigericin, 1 hour, 2 hour, and this is your NinjaOne knockout where there should be no signal, and there isn't. But you will see that in the absence of any stimulus, NinjaOne is largely monomeric, with a few oligomeric species. But very quickly, within an hour, it's almost entirely polymeric. And that coincides with the immunostaining, that the plasma membrane staining now becomes, after nigericin treatment, becomes this sort of starry sky punctate staining in the plasma membrane, as if you're forming these large aggregates that don't happen in the knockout. So the question is, what is the stimulus that allows this to go to that? And presumably, we think for megapores. What is that stimulus? Now, we don't know, but we haven't found any post-translational modification. So we think that NinjaOne, maybe through its transmembrane domains, assesses the health of the plasma membrane, either the tension or the composition. And that's why so many triggers converge on NinjaOne. But that's an open question. But what certainly happens with activation is this oligomerization. Okay, so why is it conserved? So one question, one possibility is that maybe you need acute cell lysis and the dumping of damps to get an optimal inflammatory response. It's early days. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's a possibility. But let us say that is. Then you would say that the Ninja-1 null mice would be more susceptible to bacterial infection and relatively resistant to sterile inflammation. Now, is that the case? Indeed, if we look at a Citrobacter rodentium infection, where the wild-type mice will clear the infection, Ninja-1 knockouts are more susceptible. If we look at a form of sterile inflammation, this is a very high-dose intratracheal instillation of bleomycin. Wild-type mice precipitously lose body weight. The Ninja-1s are relatively protected. Now, what we really need, this is genetic data. It's a knockout, and then you have a challenge. We need something that will allow us to do an interventional study, ideally a neutralizing antibody. And why do I do that? I need to see a psychologist. As soon as I get to the most exciting slide, I switch it off. Dang. And we have such a reagent. We have a neutralizing antibody. So this is the release of a large molecular weight dye on exposure to nigericin as a function of time, 0, 5, 10, 15, 20 hours. Wild-type cells will release the dye. The knockouts don't release the dye. But if you take the wild-type cells and incubate them with this antibody, then they're just as inhibited as the knockout. So this is going to be a very important tool in future studies. What is the structure? Now, we don't have it, but we put it on grids, cryo-EM, and I felt like what Howard Carter felt like when he first peered into Tutankhamun's tomb and somebody asked him, can you see anything? And he said, yes, wonderful things. And we see these sort of circular conglomerations of Ninja-1 monomers, almost daisy-chained, and they would be about 100, 120 nanometers, really, really large. And they have structures. If you go to higher resolution, their sawtooth pattern is packed alpha helical bundles. So we are hoping that a structural understanding of this event is within striking distance. Okay, so I talked about Gesdermindi, which was surprising in itself. And then I finished up about talking about Ninja-1, which is really surprising. And I'm not sure we understand everything there is to be understood about Ninja-1. My favorite hypothesis, which is there are three ninjas in the fly. So if you knock at least two of them out, then they are more susceptible to intracellular pathogens. And that makes me think that maybe that's the other reason for evolutionary conservation, is the very rapid expulsion of intracellular pathogens. But time will tell. All right. Miriam, you got that? All right. Miriam's my African sister, so for those of you who don't know. All right, so the work was done by Nobuhiko Kayagaki. We've collaborated with his lab is in my department. We've worked hand in glove for the past 20 years, and his group, Irma Stowe, Bettina Lee, and Ofer Kornfeld. They've worked with Kamla on the structure, and this has been a long-standing collaboration with Chris Goodnow and Ed Bertram. This, the forward genetics, is a huge undertaking. So with that, I'll stop.